My guest today is Aaron Rabinowitz of Embrace the Void and Philosophers in Space. He teaches at Rutgers University in the philosophy department. We first spoke a month or so back on the Right to Reason podcast about consciousness, and we'll be continuing that conversation today. We discussed neutral monism, property dualism, panpsychism, Alvin Plantinga's evolutionary argument against naturalism, and at the end, he's also subjected to a realist-anti-realist lightning round. So without further ado, let's get to my conversation with Aaron Rabinowitz. So I went from substance dualist to materialist 5 or 6 years ago, and just stayed there for quite a while, because I thought those were basically the only two options, and materialism is the clear winner for me. Then a couple years ago, I started to make modifications to my physicalism, until I ended up with a version of physicalism that most physicalists don't like very much. Can you give us an outline of your evolution on consciousness, and how you eventually ended up with the views you have today?
I would say that I haven't been like firmly settled on a particular position. I wasn't really strongly out and out for substance dualism at one point or something like that, the way you're describing. I would say I was always pretty firmly in the camp of phenomenal consciousness is real and is an important phenomenon that is not functionally accessible from the objective kinds of points of view. And I think I probably started out as a kind of property dualist, physicalist kind of view, and have since shifted to something like a neutral monist kind of view.
Can you define neutral monism?
Sure, I can try. So neutral monism would be the view that that there is sort of three things, quote unquote, in the universe. There are physical properties, there are mental properties, and then there is a neutral substance, which is neither physical nor mental, that is that both physical and mental properties adhere in and are able to interact with each other via that sort of connection through the neutral substance. That's the view, as I understand it.
So are all three fundamental, or is just the third one fundamental?
Well, so what do we mean by fundamental here?
Fundamental reality. Where do our explanations come to an end, I guess? Well, why is it complicated why is fundamental reality a term that has to be?
So I think it gets a little fuzzy for me because when I think of this neutral monist substance, I sometimes think about like Spinoza's God or nature, or the, as I mentioned earlier, the Tao in Taoism. And it's sort of a question of like, one way to put it would be the neutral substance is the foundation of reality. And both physical and mental properties can emerge from that fundamental kind of reality. Another way to put it would be that all three of them are, in a sense, fundamental. They're all essential to the nature of reality, but they don't all appear in all the same places.
So this third substance is neither mental nor physical. When you put it together in configurations, it emerges in physical matter or in mental reality?
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem with this view, because all of these views have problems, right? I don't think that I have a great solution or anything like that. This is my way of conceptualizing and understanding something that is fundamentally mysterious to me. But sort of the idea would be the substance exists and is, you know, sort of potentially infinite and exists everywhere at all times, and depending on how you make sense of that. And then, physical or mental properties can kind of emerge. And the blanket model is the way this is sometimes described, where it's like there's a big blanket and sometimes certain parts of it get twisted up in ways that we talk about as if they were physical properties or mental properties.
Okay, so is it fair to say that really there's just this neutral substance and it has mental properties or physical properties depending on what specific configuration you're talking about?
Yeah, that's basically the way that I see it. Mm-hmm.
So is there any problem with emergence on your view as you see it? Like, is there any, this is just basically weak emergence mm-hmm. when you're talking about physical properties emerging and with mental properties emerging?
Yeah, I don't think there's a kind of problem the same way that you would have with substance property dualism, right? Where you have mental properties emerging from physical properties. Now, there are some complexities, I guess, in the sense that, I think that certain mental properties emerge as a result of certain physical properties existing in certain parts of the blanket, as it were. And so you might argue that a kind of emergence problem could re-emerge in that kind of situation. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of pre-caveating that I do not necessarily think that it's best to describe this view in panpsychist kinds of terms. And so I acknowledge that there may still be some kinds of emergence problems, because there's also a problem here of, like, you know, the fundamental issue with this view is what the hell is this neutral substance? Like,
right.
What does it do? What properties does it have if it has neither physical nor mental properties? And how does it causally interact with either of them?
Right. What is it? It's not physical. Yeah. It's not mental. Well, yeah. What is that?
I don't know. It is the great mystery of the universe.
It's the great mystery.
As the Tao Te Ching would say, right?
As we all know.
Mystery beyond mystery.
The Tao Te Ching. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Okay. I was just reading this paper the other day called Is Property Dualism Any Better Off Than Substance Dualism? And mm-hmm. I wasn't sure exactly what your view was, but I thought maybe I was detecting some property dualism. So I dragged mm-hmm. this paper out before we started recording. But it said, it's funny because I never realized that property dualism suffers from the interaction problem just as much as substance dualism, because how could
100%.
Non-physical properties causally affect physical properties any more than, you know, a non-physical substance? So the only way out of it really is epiphenomenalism, and that has its own host of problems. So it's like the interaction problem, which is usually thought to be, you know, totally fatal to substance dualism, also applies mm-hmm. to this, you know, property dualism, which pretty much seems to get a pass from, like, everyone.
Unless you're a mysterian like me. But yes. You're generally right that, like, they have the exact same level of problem. So, but that being said, I will also say I would, you know, if my neutral monism doesn't pan out because everyone hates the idea that we can't describe this substance and that, you know, that is a real problem. I would sooner collapse into property dualism than panpsychism, because I feel like we need to be able to talk about sentience in a way where it doesn't really make sense to say that a rock is sentient in any way like we are sentient. So I think that matters. But I know you don't. We already did that one a bunch, and I want to have you on my show as well to debate that in emergence further.
Yeah, totally. I mean, emergence is one of the main drivers for panpsychism, and you know who made a really good case for it was Hunter Ash, the guest that you had a while back, mm-hmm. talking about how could a real property that belongs to fundamental reality be vague? And then he kind of argues that consciousness is, like, one of the only non-vague things that we know of, if not the only thing.
Yeah, I mean, I love Hunter, and I'm sympathetic to that argument. So here's what I'll say, right? I think we needed an important explanation for... If the panpsychist can provide this, then maybe I can be more sympathetic to the view. If they can explain why it seems like there is some clean distinction between entities like rocks and electrons, which they theoretically claim have phenomenal consciousness, but we don't treat them as phenomenal agents or patients the way that we treat living organisms that have phenomenal consciousness. If they can explain why, you know, either we should treat them the way we do everything else that has consciousness in the way that we've generally traditionally understood it, or you know, can they make some sort of clear distinction between morally relevant consciousness and non-morally relevant consciousness, then I would be much more back on board with considering the theory, I think.
But that's why panpsychism is more of a project than like a theory, mm-hmm. where it's like, okay, this is sort of a research project. Like, you could take that up theoretically. Like, you could say, like, how could a panpsychist make moral distinctions between a rock and a person, or, you know, a cow and an electron? You know, it is a question that, I mean, it's not obvious to me at all that that question can't be answered. Like, the questions that you're raising about morality, sure. like panpsychism, it's research that just hasn't been done yet.
Yeah, my initial problem is I don't feel like I understand at all what the locution means when panpsychists say a rock has sentience. It feels to me like using the words in a move that is not in keeping with the rules of the language game, right? Is one way to put it.
Strictly speaking, they wouldn't say rocks have sentience. They would say that, you know, a rock is made of particles, that it's like something sure. to be those particles, but the rock is not a subject of experience in the same way that you are. But
right, but then I would have to understand why me and the rock are both made of the same sentient particles, but the rock is not a subject of experience and I am. That's the part that I'm concerned about.
It would just come down to, you know, the specific configuration or arrangement. Like, in the same way that everything on the periodic table is made of the same three ingredients, but you just arrange them in different ways and you get all these different properties. Like if you take matter and arrange it in a different way, which we already know this is true from, you know, our own case. Like, if you take the matter that you're made of,
is a unique thing, right? Here's what I would say. If that's the answer, then it seems like you have an emergence problem still, where what you're saying is, you know, sentience or sentience is fundamental to all of reality, but the special kind of personhood being a, you know, subject of experience sentience emerges from the right arrangement of particles. And then you still seems like you have a weird emergence situation.
Right, because of combination.
Right. We're sort of backdooring our way into the combination problem, which
right.
it seems like to me hasn't been, and I don't see how it could be sort of functionally resolvable in that way.
It seems like an easier problem, though, to say, how does the content of experience change? Well, it changes by changing the configuration of its parts. That seems like a more plausible path forward to me than saying, well, if you just rearrange the parts, experience itself emerges, rather than just the contents of experience changing. If I change the arrangement of the matter that I'm made of, then the contents of my experience change. So that's kind of the difference between you and me, and the difference between you and me and the rock. It's just an arrangement issue.
Yeah, I didn't follow your set. You just said something that sounded to me like, you know, X is different from saying X. And so I'm confused about what you were saying in the first half of that about how these are really genuinely separable things, to say that this is caused by the arrangement of the parts, but because the arrangement of the parts has theoretically been assigned this low-level sentience, that you're still not just sort of fundamentally saying that, like, the right arrangement of physical particles brings about sentience in the kind of way that we experience it, even if those particles also have a proto kind of sentience that is nothing like we understand it.
I mean, don't you see the appeal of saying, like, well, I know that if I change the arrangement of matter in me, then my experiences will change. And then we just kind of logically walk that back and back and back. And then, you know, eventually we're explaining states of consciousness in terms of, like, simpler states of consciousness. Just like we're explaining, you know, complex forms of life in terms of simpler forms of life.
It seems like it's metaphorical to me that when you start to reduce down below the level of the person and into the composites that make up the person, whether you are, it seems like you're making the exact same moves that the physicalists are, and then saying, but these atomic particles that we've reduced down to at the very end necessarily also have consciousness. But it's not the kind of consciousness that we had up at the top level, but it does allow for the sustaining of the consciousness at the top level, though it's not quite clear how.
Well, it is the same type of consciousness at the top level as it is on the bottom level, in the sense that they both are characterized by the fact that it's like something to be. So you do have that in common with fundamental reality.
But then I get confused. So, like, is it like something to be an electron?
I think it has to be.
So does that mean that there can be... Does that mean that electrons have interests, for example?
No, I think that something like an interest is an emergent property of, you know, if you configure matter in a specific way, just in the same way a personality is an emergent property of a chunk of matter out there.
But so if something is sentient, it seems to me that it necessarily has to... If there's something it's like to be an entity, then it seems to me that... Unless, you know, like, unless its experiences are so radically different from mine as to be totally incomprehensible to me, in which case I don't know how to theorize it about it very well, then there has to be something like it going better or worse for that thing. So, for example, like, is it bad for an electron to be destroyed where it no longer has something it's like to be it?
Well, I mean, I think that valenced experience can go down a lot farther than... I mean, I think it goes down farther than probably most people think it does, but it's a very simple type of positive or negative valence of experience. And I think that all of our complex forms of positive and negative valence emerge out of simpler forms of, you know, positive and negatively valenced states of consciousness.
Yeah, I just think that, to me, I'm still convinced by the good old-fashioned evolutionary adaptive model, which says that, like, when you have sufficiently complicated living organisms, it becomes adaptive for them to have sensory apparatus. And as they develop those, phenomenal consciousness emerges or evolves in those organisms because it is adaptive for it to do so. Whereas it never develops in a rock because it's not, because a rock is not the sort of thing that, like, has either the capacity or the interests to bring up, you know, like, the desire to use those capacities. Mm. So I'm still sympathetic to that model, and I feel like it's a much more plausible emergence. I mean, like, I understand the problems with emergentism, I guess, but I still think that that's, it seems to better track what we are actually talking about when we are talking about sentience than this idea that of trying to make sense of what it's like to be an electron.
I still think, though, that the combination problem is less of an emergence problem than the emergence of sentience itself. Like, that seems like a more radical emergence than simply saying, well, complex forms of consciousness emerge from simple forms of consciousness. Saying consciousness,
oh, I think it's more theoretically radical, for sure. I just think that it's more empirically and conceptually coherent, that it tracks the what we know about evolution, and that it tracks what we know about ourselves, and that the view that the alternative view that this kind of low level consciousness that is not valenced could, you know, come together to create the kind of consciousness that we experience as valenced seems...
It's funny you bring up the evolution point, though, because I feel like evolution kind of works exactly against what you're saying. In that a lot of... actually, I think Hunter quoted one on your show of one of these, like, early adopters of Darwinism. A huge number of them were panpsychists. And it's because, like, a lot of them were led to it just by thinking about evolution. But yeah, there were a lot of, like, late 19th century panpsychists who were convinced.
Here's what I would say. If they'd been given the option of neutral monism, I'm curious if they would have taken that. Or like, if their panpsychism would fit better under the category of what I've described as neutral monism. Because I think we have to talk about the localized nature of the kinds of sentience that seem morally relevant, for example. And I just, you know, I think that there's clearly one strong theoretical upside to panpsychism, but I find it unilluminating on a variety of other fronts and obscuring on a variety of other fronts. And so when I have to net out which view, you know, I like the best in terms of costs and benefits, it doesn't do it for me compared to some of the other ones, is how I end up on this.
Well, let me ask you a question about your neutral monism, because mm-hmm. we're talking about emergent physical properties and emergent, I don't know if you want to call them immaterial properties, but mental properties. Mm-hmm. Isn't there sort of an issue with, just in the same way it's kind of confusing why immaterial properties would emerge from physical objects, which is the property with the problem with property dualism. Isn't the problem sort of multiplied on neutral monism, where now you have this thing that's not physical, not mental, but you have mental properties that emerge and physical properties that emerge? So now it's like you have two hard problems.
Yeah, certainly.
Isn't that worse than just having one?
I mean, it's better if it's right. It's worse if it's wrong. I mean, here's what I'll say. It's better if it's right, though it does suck if it's right. But it's better to have a sucky truth, right, than a parsimonious falsehood, it seems to me.
Well,
so
you should apply that to your complaints about panpsychism, that it's a confusing factor on the one hand, and it doesn't illuminate things in the moral ways that you're speaking about.
Oh, for sure. I'm totally sympathetic to those concerns about my own view. I'm a mysterian who, when pushed on it, will explain why one theory feels slightly better to me than the other theories, but they're all terrible theories, and like none of them are solving the problem anytime soon, in my opinion. So if you push me, I will always go back to saying, look, all of these theories have very deep problems, and none of them are satisfactorily resolving our intuitions and, you know, resolving them in relation to empirical information in viable ways. So I think I stick with the truth that you can't deny phenomenal experience. And beyond that, I am open to suggestion.
Well, that much we definitely agree on. I'm just baffled every time. Like, every time I hear about someone who denies phenomenal consciousness, it's like, I must not know what you mean, because how could you possibly?
Yeah, and I think that the folks who get closest to that when you press them on that will say that's not what they're claiming. But if you it becomes a kind of Mott and Bailey, where I feel like when they're not being pressed on it, that is what they're saying.
It sucks, but I'm ultimately a mysterian too, because every once in a while it'll just dawn on me. Well, I didn't answer my own question I asked you for the other episode on counter-apologetics, which is, mm-hmm. I really like Alvin Plantinga as a Christian philosopher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a name that comes up in my head. I would say I haven't read enough of him to like say whether I like him very strongly, but I think my father really likes him, for example.
Mm. I've read a lot of his papers. I haven't read any of his books, though. But I think that he is an interesting philosopher in his own right. And, you know, his weird religious views you can kind of put to one side and still appreciate what he's saying about, you know, phenomenology or something like that, or foundationalism. Are you familiar with his evolutionary argument against naturalism?
No.
It's basically just like evolution will create systems that are good at surviving and having cognitive faculties that help you discern mm-hmm. metaphysical truths is not mm-hmm. necessarily adaptive. It might even be maladaptive, like Brian Greene has argued. The thing that's being produced here is something that will help you with, you know, the four Fs. It's not really designed to help you discern metaphysical truths. So if you're a naturalist, so he's trying to say naturalism is kind of self-refuting. You see where this is going, like where, you know, sure. naturalistic evolution is something that you're ascertaining with your cognitive faculties that you have no reason to trust.
Yeah, there's a couple of ways you can respond to that. You wanted a response, I assume.
Well, I was just bringing it up. I mean, the most obvious response is just, you know, seeing the way things actually are, and, you know, having truth-making faculties is obviously adaptive in numerous right. ways. And when you try to start hashing out what it would look like to have faculties that, like, don't lead you to something that corresponds to reality in any way, the situations just get so absurd that it's like, this is obviously the path of least resistance.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple other responses that I'm sympathetic to from, like, Blind Side is a book that I really love when I teach philosophy of mind. It's a science fiction book that raises this concern about maybe phenomenal consciousness is maladaptive and, like, is a weird freak accident that happened on our planet but is not common to life in the greater universe. So one pushback on his view is he takes too narrow a view of what manages to evolve, in the sense that he buys this sort of naive view that only things that are adaptive evolve. And yes, it's true that adaptivity drives evolution, but there are a variety of features that we have that are either neutral or were adaptive at some previous point or are mildly maladaptive, but they're associated with things that are adaptive, and so they stick around. And so it's possible that, like, phenomenal consciousness is something that emerged either by accident or alongside some other features and then stuck around. That's the epiphenomenalist kind of answer to that objection. But I'm not an epiphenomenalist, so I don't buy that view. I do think consciousness is adaptive. And I think, you know, this is the same problem that people raise with moral realism and naturalism, is that they say that, like, we couldn't, you know, we evolved our moral senses because it was adaptive, and so they don't track the truth. And so there's no reason to think they're reliable. But I think that through the use of our cognitive faculties, which were adaptive for a variety of reasons long ago, we can use those systems to bootstrap our knowledge of ourselves and of the universe upwards in ways that give us a better approach to our universe.
I mean, the thing that makes me uncomfortable, though, is that mm-hmm. he's not totally wrong in that our faculties weren't designed just to be metaphysical truth weighers. And, you know, like,
sure,
it's part of the reason why, you know, at least I'm a Mysterian. I don't know if it's your motivator as well, but it's like every once in a while it'll dawn on me that there's really no reason to trust my cognitive faculties. Like he talked about Darwin's Doubt. I think that is a title of like an intelligent design mm-hmm. book, but it's also like Darwin said something at one point where he mentioned, you know, who would trust the convictions in a monkey's mind? And it's like, yeah, my intuitions, why should I even trust them? Like, why should I trust my intuitions? Because ultimately those are the things that are making me weigh all these considerations and, you know, leading me to these conclusions. And obviously, you know, our faculties are somewhat designed to ascertain truth, because that's, mm-hmm. you know, the path to least resistance for all kinds of things that are selected for. But at the end of the day, I do kind of have to be a Mysterian, because there's just no reason that I would be able to discern the truth about reality. And at the end of the day, it's just kind of a game that I even am trying.
Yeah, and I'm certainly sympathetic to that, and that's why I'm a skeptic in a variety of ways. It's why I'm, you know, very cognizant that all of my beliefs are the result of luck, and you know, they could have just as much been very different beliefs, and I still would have held them probably just as strongly. You know, I don't go so far as to say that I therefore can't have any knowledge, or can't even have knowledge of, you know, abstract things like ethics. I still think that we can. I just think that this should induce in us a sense of great care and responsibility in trying to make sense of these issues, because we are just monkeys who are trying to understand things that we were not perfectly designed to understand. And so we're going to make a lot of mistakes along the way.
Well, I would say it's time to put you in the hot seat and subject you to the same.
We haven't done that yet.
It's been smooth. It's been easy so far, but you're about to be subjected to the same torture that you subject everyone else to on Embrace the Void. Fair. So you can vent
your... I deserve that.
You do. And but I don't hate you. I pity you. And
there you go.
It really is torture, though, for like philosophically inclined people. Because I ran a couple of these questions by normal people, and they were like, mm-hmm. what's the problem?
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh, man, I wish I could go back to that sometimes, just not even understanding that these are questions that would someday cause me literal agony just to hear someone only be able to give one word answers to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You can vent your frustrations at the end, but you can only answer real or not real once the question is clear to you.
Okay.
And I've added my own throughout. The external world.
Real.
Colors.
Real.
The historical Jesus.
Real.
Not a mythicist. Okay. Neither am I, but phenomenal consciousness.
Real, for sure.
Intentionality.
Real.
Yeah. Free will.
Not real.
The suicide of Jeffrey Epstein.
Oh.
So real would be he killed himself.
Not real.
Oh, really? You think he was murdered?
No, I don't know.
Okay.
I think that I wouldn't be at all surprised if it was that way.
Yeah, me either. Never mind. He didn't kill himself. Okay, the self.
Not real.
Gender.
Real.
Real this time. Okay. Sex.
Like biological sex?
Yeah.
Real.
Race.
I would say not real.
Mm. Well, that's weird because I thought you were a part of the superior one, but...
All right. That's true, except for Jews. Jews are a real race.
Species?
Not real.
Morality?
Real.
Human rights?
Real.
The is-ought gap?
Real, I think.
Yeah. But you can just start with an ought, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Knowledge?
Real.
Mental causation?
Real.
God?
Not real.
An afterlife?
I genuinely, I like, how do I have judgment about something that I have literally no views on, no understanding of?
It sounds like more than one word.
Yeah, you're right. Not real.
Not real. Society?
Real.
The fine-tuning problem?
Real.
Teleology?
Real.
Numbers?
Real.
Fictional characters?
Not real.
Social constructions?
Real.
Holes?
Real.
Chairs?
Not real.
That's how you know you're talking to a philosopher. All right. Possible worlds?
Real.
Human nature?
Real.
Universal grammar?
Lots of language is hard. Real.
Sandwiches?
Not real.
Science?
Real.
Okay. Natural laws?
Real.
Beauty?
Real.
Causation?
Real.
Monads?
Real.
Well, then you're a panpsychist. Okay.
No, I'm not.
And finally, non-conscious matter.
Real.
Boo. Okay. So there you go. You made
it. I'm not a panpsychist.
So what's your system? Do you have a consistent real, not real discerning?
I mean, as all my guests will tell you, right, real means different things in different contexts, and so it's unfair to apply a concept like real simpliciter. So my system is it's a kind of pragmatic system of, like, is it useful for this particular thing to talk about it in terms of real or not real? I generally tie it to objectivity, is something objectively, but then... yeah, I think that's probably the way that I go with it. But I also like certain things that I think are social constructs in a way that makes them robustly, effectively objective. I consider it valuable to talk about those as real. So, like, for example, you know, I think it's important to talk about genders being real, but it's harmful to talk about races being real, because when people think of races, they think biological race, not culturally constructed race a lot of the time.
Yeah, that's an interesting... Have you encountered many pragmatists when you do the lightning round?
Yeah, but they mostly all just say not real because they're people like Liam. I haven't had anyone who's told me that that's their particular method, but that's the one that I've been kind of developing, I suppose. And it like means that like certain things go back and forth between real or less real as I feel whether or not they are useful to be discussed in that kind of way.
Yeah. And, you know, hearing all the questions in a row has the value of forcing you to come up with some kind of generalized mm-hmm. idea of what counts as real, which I realized I didn't have until I heard your lightning round.
Yeah, and I don't think I have a remotely consistent one or anything. I think I probably don't even give the same answers if I'm asked these questions on multiple occasions. Like, I don't think there's a lot of them where I would answer differently depending on the day.
Well, you've been more than generous with your time, and thank you so much for giving me almost 2 hours here. But yeah, there'll be one episode on counter-apologetics and one on Walden Pod.
Sweet, no problem. Thanks for having me. It's been fun chat.
Absolutely.